In the days of letter writing and postcards, I did get a big post bag from readers who would tell me what they'd been going on, or coincidences, or sometimes they would write us quite a sad letter, say about their divorce, and say, you know, what do you think I should do? And I would write back and say, well, I'm really not equipped to, you know, to tell you what to do.
The voice you heard there was that of the cartoonist and writer Posy Simmons, and this is another episode of In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. Posy started out in the late 1960s. She started up drawing cartoons and illustrations for various newspapers and magazines, but by the late 1970s she was doing a regular comic strip in The Guardian. It had this big cast of returning characters. The sort of main couple were Wendy and George Webber, who, as she says in this interview, were woolly liberals. But in the comics, there were parenting dilemmas, awkward party conversations, people cheating on each other. It was so funny, and it became such a fleshed out universe with all these characters who you remembered, because one of them would always be pretentious, and, you know, then there would be somebody who, whenever he showed up, was drunk and sleazy, and then there was, you know, someone who was very anxious. I've been rereading them recently and they're totally brilliant. Posy has also written and illustrated children's books, and she's published several graphic novels. Gemma Bovary, Tamara Drew and Cassandra Dark were all adaptations of famous literary novels with a Posy Simmons twist. In France, where graphic novelists and cartoonists are treated with the respect that they deserve, more so than they are here in the UK, she had a major exhibition earlier this year at the Pompidou Centre in Paris. She also won the very prestigious Grand Prix at the Angoulême International Comics Festival, which is a very big deal indeed. I grew up in a Posy Simmons household. My parents had The Guardian delivered, and so we all read her comic strips and we bought her books at Christmas, and it was very exciting for me a few weeks ago to be able to go and visit her at her beautiful flat, which has this astonishing view over central London, and talk to her about her work. Afterwards, she even showed me the early character studies that she mentions for Cassandra Dark, including drawings of Cassandra wearing different hats. In the interview, she explains how she brings people to life on the page, the challenges of basing a story on a classic, and how the character of Gemma Bovary started to fight against the plot that Posy had planned out for her. Before we start, a quick note about Curtis Brown Creative, the renowned writing school run by the Literary and Talent Agency, who are sponsoring this season of In Writing. Unleash your inner artist. Join Curtis Brown Creative's 10-week online Writing and Illustrating a Children's Picture Book course. Learn from best-selling children's author illustrators David O'Connell and Sarah McIntyre as they walk you through the wonderful world of picture books, from character design to crafting short and snappy prose. Curtis Brown Creative also run a wide variety of courses focused on different genres, from romance novels to crime fiction. There's something on offer for every type of writer. Curtis Brown Creative have provided an exclusive discount for In Writing listeners. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the full price of Writing and Illustrating a Children's Picture Book or any other short online course. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. Now, over to Posy. This is the room where you work.
Yes, it is.
Would you describe it for people listening?
It's quite light. It's got a lot of natural light. One end, it's got a desk with my laptop on, and shelves above it, which are full of pencils and inks and crayons and things. There are bookcases one side, and a plan chest the other side, and then at the other end there's my drawing board, which is where I suppose I spend most of the time, at the drawing board. And it is in rather a mess.
It's not in a mess at all. I was just thinking how immaculate it is.
Really?
Yeah, it's so tidy, and it's such a lovely room. You've got a big mirror above your drawing board, and a big angle poise lamp, and just everything looks like it's in its right place in here.
Yes, well, I suppose it has to be. It's not a big room, but it does. And it's also got my archive in it, which are lots and lots of boxes.
I can see that. Box 25, Tamara Drew.
Yes.
That's quite exciting. You said that you've downsized in the last few years, and you said you had a much bigger room previously.
Yes, I did. It had it looked out onto a walled garden. It had a sofa, it had armchairs, yes, it and it had bookcases sort of up to the ceiling. And so when we moved, we had to get rid of 2,000 books.
Did you give them to charity, or were there too many for that?
Yeah, we gave quite a lot to charity. We gave quite a lot to Hay on Wye.
Oh, that's good.
So eventually, we got rid of them. They were just books everywhere. They were breeding. They were out of control.
Yeah. Was it painful to move from a larger room to a smaller room for your workspace, or was it quite liberating?
I think it was liberating in a way, because I was able to throw away so much rubbish. I'd never thrown bank statements going back to 1969. There they were. I've had an awful lot of odd socks. there was absolutely, I mean, so much rubbish there. So in a way, it was a relief. I'm not very tidy, but I'm a bit tidier than I was here, because I've got to be, because, I wouldn't be able to work. And it was a sort of wrench. The loss of a bigger studio, because there were also very nice sort of slanted surfaces where I could lay out a book and I could see the progression, that sort of thing.
Are you working on something at the moment? There is something on your drawing board that I'm just nosily trying to look at over your shoulder. Are you working on a project?
Yes, I am. I am. Yes.
Can you tell me anything about it, or is it in secret stage?
It's sort of early days. I've had interruptions. But it'll be a graphic novel, and usually I've worked on things which are contemporary, mostly. Yes, I think they're mostly the graphic novels. Yes, they're set in the here and now. This one's set about 1959, 1960, which I think is quite an interesting date, because it's towards the end of an era. It's pre-pill, it's pre-Beatles, it's pre-miniskirts. It's when a sort of old order was still there and operating. So I find that quite interesting.
Yeah, and towards the sort of dying days of the old order, and people feeling a bit impatient for change, maybe.
Yes. I mean, I sort of remember it. I mean, how old was I? I was about 14 then. Yes, I remember it quite a lot. And I've looked at old diaries for some of the language, for the slang and things like that.
Oh, that's fantastic. Your diaries?
Yes.
Do you have a lot of diaries?
No. But these ones... These ones sort of survived the move.
So when you're working on something, what's your sort of working routine?
I suppose now, because I'm doing this project in my own time, the routine's slightly different. But in the past, for instance, both the first two graphic novels, Gemma Bovary and Tamara Drew, were serialized in The Guardian, and so I had to produce for Gemma Bovary an episode appeared every day, and for Tamara
Drew,
and for Tamara Drew it was two episodes a week, so it was very full on, and I knew almost every day what the pressure would be, that it was collected on a Thursday. about lunchtime, after which I would have a really nice lunch and probably go out and, you know, see friends. And then Friday would be sort of all right, although I'd be doing things and, you know, catching up with correspondence and things like that. Saturday, I'd be starting to get a bit worried about the drawing, the episode ahead. And I sort of would know slightly what happened. But I never worked ahead, which would have been sensible. But on the other hand, it was rather interesting working on this thing which wasn't quite finished, which was still hatching. And I know I wouldn't have made the decisions I did about the plot if I'd had 6 months to think about it. It was really sitting on a pile of hot conkers at my desk, which kind of, you know, made me think, that won't happen, but this will.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you about that, because I found an interview that I think you gave earlier this year about your exhibition at the Pompidou and about looking back at your life's work. And you described your life's work as a long series of deadlines. And you said, I can still recognise the panic in certain drawings. And I thought that was so funny. But I also thought, I wonder if that sort of enforced discipline of having deadlines and being a working, you know, working person who had to hand things in and make a living, do you think that was good for your work?
I think it was probably good for my work and probably not so good for me to always be on this. Obviously when I was much younger, it was, you know, I could cope with it. I couldn't do it now. Now I'm old. A weekly deadline, I couldn't do. But I suppose having a deadline, it concentrates your thoughts. When I first joined The Guardian, I was a sort of, I was an illustrator, I was really, or a cartoonist. I was sort of a dog's body, really good job to have when you're young, that they would, in those days, they would ring up and say, the hole in the page is so big, it could be 8 columns wide by 2 inches, or it could be a tiny little matchbox shaped, and they would say, come in and pick up the copy. And because I lived quite near The Guardian at that time, I would go in, pick up the copy, rush back home, read it, do the drawing, and then deliver it that afternoon. Or sometimes I got till the next day. So it was very, very tight. So you had no time to redraw. So if you did an awful drawing, I mean, that was tough. You had to... But also, the drawing just had a life of one day, that it appeared the next day in the paper with people's toast and marmalade. And by the evening, it was in the cat litter tray or around the fish, you know, that nowadays things hang around forever. But it was, in a way, quite a nice thing, this kind of mayfly existence of a drawing.
Yeah, I felt like that. I worked... briefly for The Times for a year,
yeah,
and I found that quite freeing. The thought that, I don't know, there's just so much in a newspaper, there's this constant churn, and
yes,
even if it does live on online, people don't really go back and read most things in a newspaper. And so I did, you know, I don't know if it was probably bad for my standards in terms of, like, you know, I couldn't be a perfectionist, I had to just get things done and hand them in, but it was very good for my decisiveness, I think, and just letting it go rather than procrastinating endlessly about which word was better.
There weren't things that you really thought, oh God, I wish I had more time on that.
Or, yeah, probably.
Probably.
I mean, probably things that if I read them now, I would be horrified by them, but I don't read them, and there were so many of them that you just have to get on with it, don't you? So
Yes, absolutely. There's always tomorrow.
Yeah. So now I've derailed the question that I asked you, which was, what is your routine with it now, with work?
So now, I mean, I always turn up. I think Woody Allen, that was one of Woody Allen's things about script writing. You just turn up, which means you turn up at your desk. And I mean, I like to be at my desk sort of 9:15-ish. And with exhibitions and things that have been happening recently, there have been lots of interruptions. And so my routine hasn't been the same. I've had meetings, or I've had to go to Paris, or, you know, this and that, or I've had to do posters, that sort of thing. But usually, in the ordinary way, I'd work till lunchtime, 1 o'clock, have an hour and a half for lunch. I always walk every day for at least an hour, and sometimes more. I mean, I really love walking. I've always walked. In London, I can't drive. In fact, so I'm always on my feet.
Is there a walk you really like in London? Do you walk into the city or?
Yeah, I walk a lot. I walk a lot in the city because I like all these little back streets and whatever they're called, ginnels and little passages. Yes, I can wiggle my way through the city very well. During COVID, when we were still, the first year of COVID, when we were still at our old house, I used to walk absolutely miles with a friend, and we'd go up river as far as Canary Wharf, or sometimes we'd wiggle all our way all around Bloomsbury. Yeah.
Lovely. What do you describe yourself as? Because obviously you're a writer, you're an illustrator, you're a cartoonist. Is that an appropriate word, or a comic?
Yes.
Artist.
I was definitely cartoonist most of my career, partly because that's what, if you drew for the press or you drew for magazines, that's what you were. But then the world of comics has sort of become a big, great big tent, which is now includes everybody. And for most of my career, working for newspapers, which was sort of a sphere of its own. I mean, I didn't know very many people who worked in comics at all. Mm. And it wasn't until Gemma Bovary was published in French, and that I went to do publicity over there, that I realised that actually I was now in the world of comics, and actually it was so interesting to be included in this much, much bigger group of people. People who do superheroes, people who do manga, people of every nationality. And they're big comic festivals, as you probably know. So you see lots of friends. It's very nice.
Yeah, and it's such a huge scene in France, isn't it? And more so than here, but perhaps it's growing here.
It's certainly growing here. Yes, it's huge in France and Belgium. And the USA as well. But France is the sort of, I suppose, centre of it. And it's very extraordinary. I can remember when we first started going to France quite a lot, which was probably the beginning of the 80s. I can remember going into bookshops in Paris, and you'd see children on the floor reading bande dessinée, comic books, and their parents reading them, and you'd see comic books in supermarkets, and it was absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So what is the term that you think of yourself as?
I think I'm still a cartoonist, but sometimes I'm a graphic novelist, and I think I'm also an author.
Yeah.
Author, illustrator, cartoonist,
so many hats.
Very various things. I can remember one year in the census, my husband, we were thinking, when it said occupation, we thought, well, what are we? So we put ourselves down as visual engineers.
Why not? Yeah.
Why not?
Your first professional cartoonist work was for The Sun, is that right?
Yes, it was the Sun and then a motley collection of things, because I was very much starting out. So there were, I drew for The Times, The Observer, a magazine called New Society, quite a lot for Reader's Digest, Cosmopolitan, anywhere that was, you know, got a space. I did quite a lot for Woman's Own at one point. Small drawings on advice about tax and that sort of thing.
When did you start? Was it at The Guardian that you felt that you started really kind of carving out the topics that you were interested in and the...
Yes, I think so. I mean, for The Sun, I did a small thing which was really sort of new ways with old cliches. You know, it was sort of, it got slightly boring after a bit. I mean, I wanted to write more, yeah, as well as draw.
So when you started at The Guardian and you started bringing in the characters like the Webbers and the Wrights and the families that we all got to know through your work over the years, where were you drawing inspiration from? Was it your life and your friends? And
yeah, probably quite a lot of, you know, what I noticed going on at the time. So it started in 1977, which was a time when, in the summer especially, it was very Laura Ashley, sometimes sort of milkmaid dresses and sometimes for more serious, perhaps, say, mothers, they would be very plain but also quite long with kind of important pockets to keep all the... and there were lots of Dr. Scholl's sandals.
You're basically describing my mother in the 70s, so...
Yeah. Did she have them?
Yeah.
There was quite a lot of patchwork and...
Lots of making things yourself and growing things yourself. And
yes. Trying to grow watercress on your flannel and... well, not exactly, but... I mean, there were things... It was saving the whale as well. All that was going on. I suppose Wendy and George, I think I described them as woolly liberals, that they... Their hearts were in the right place, that they were always, often their, you know, better natures or their higher ideals were sort of let down by life. And I invented, I gave them a lot of children because I thought, well, you'd always need a teenager, you need some children about 12, and you'd need some a bit younger, so there were the twins, and then someone about 2.5 or 3.
Benji. Adorable,
yes.
Benji.
Yes. Yes. And in fact, the only boy, which I remember someone saying, that's very sexist of you, that, you know, they were trying for a boy, weren't they? And I said, in their case, no, absolutely not.
Rereading them, I was struck that there are some things that are, you know, that have moved on and are different now. You know, there are certain things, like there are a couple of storylines about children being smacked and that kind of thing, which I think now has sort of become almost completely
it's taboo,
forbidden.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But there are so many things that either haven't changed or have sort of come back around, and you've got these parents who are, you know, they're worried about nuclear war and they're worried about making sure that they're feeding the children organic food. And, you know, there are characters who have open relationships, and which is something that people are talking about again in the last few years. And I was, you know, thinking about my friends and thinking, this is people, you know, these are people I know now who are in their early 40s. And so much of your work has been about social observation and so well observed. Do you notice that these things come in sort of generational, you know, that everything changes but nothing changes?
Yes. I think I did notice that at the end of the 70s or the sort of Thatcher era, things changed quite a lot. It became about money. It became much more sort of carnivorous, whereas the 70s, you could say, were for herbivores. But as you say, things do come around. I'm the sort of constant about worrying about the planet. And it's awful to say, you know, constant worrying about nuclear armaments. I suppose that's been a sort of constant throughout my life, because I remember as a, you know, teenager, we were sort of terrified about nuclear, where we'd have long conversations about what we'd do in the 3-minute warning.
God, that's awful. But I did find it quite comforting to sort of remember that these worries haven't just arrived. You know, that people have always been worried about the state of the world.
And yes, yes. It,
just because we're worried doesn't mean that something catastrophic is imminent necessarily.
Not exactly. Not necessarily.
This is probably an annoying question that you've had a lot, but do the words come first, or do the images come first, or do they all come together in your mind when you're working? I mean, in the process
when I'm working on them, I would say both. I mean, sometimes an idea comes first, and it could be a visual idea. I mean, it could be the idea of a street party. In other words, this would be something I would be doing in a weekly strip for The Guardian. So I would sort of have an idea of, anyway, there'd be quite a big picture with some goings on. Otherwise, when I start working, it's often I work on a great big pad, an A2 pad, and when starting, say for a Guardian strip, which I would be doing about Monday morning, I would write down scraps of conversation. I would think, oh, what time of year is it? Like now, it's nearly Halloween. So I might draw pumpkins. I might draw people tricking and treating. Actually, I really disapprove of... I'm a grouch about Halloween, because you see all this landfill tatola in the shops, and you think it's, you know,
plastic pumpkins
and plastic pumpkins. Stuff, yeah. Yes, I get grumpy in supermarket. Anyway, but if I was going to do a cartoon about it, I would be drawing pumpkins. I'd be drawing witches' hats. I would be imagining someone opening the door. I might imagine children not getting response, putting glue in the keyhole, which they did to my neighbour.
Oh, God. That's a good trick.
Yes, good trick. So it would be... But then I would... If I hadn't got an idea on a Monday, Tuesday would be really... I would be really absolutely concentrating like mad on... Mm. On the story. And for the balloons, or the narrative, I would write that out quite a few times, because mostly I would want space for the drawing anyway, and you also want the balloons to be legible, but also as short as possible, not too wordy. And also I would read it out loud so that you've got the rhythm of the, especially a conversation, you've got the rhythm of the conversation. So sometimes my family, I think, what is she doing in there? She's talking in different voices. Sometimes I'm, you know, George, or sometimes I...
I mean, even if you're only doing a sort of 6-square strip or whatever it is, they all have a plot. I mean, they all have a you know, a payoff. I suppose it's a joke at the end, really, but that's really just a concentrated version of a plot. And was that ever, I think I would struggle to think of a way to wrap it up neatly at the end in a funny way. Did that just come to you?
Practice helps. In a way, having a format which is the same every week, you sort of get the rhythm in that usually I would start with an established... Anyway, it's a bit filmic. I would start with an establishing shot. Right, we're at the Webbers, this in the scruffy kitchen, la la. By the end of the first row, I would have wanted to set up a problem or a situation or an argument. In the middle row, I would want this argument to get stronger and for the, something to happen by the end of the second row. And in the third row, there should be, bottom left, there should be some kind of explosion or good joke. And then either a kind of payoff in the last thing, or it could be a thing like The World Said, and The World Said, what a pain in the ass you are, or, you know, that sort of... Yeah.
You mentioned words and trying to, you know, keep it as concise as possible, but I know you've also said that in France they think of you as using a lot of words in your comic strips.
I think abroad they were talking about Gemma Bovary, which certainly had a lot of text in it. And at the time, I wasn't fully familiar with the... There is a sort of French and Belgian or Italian format for bande dessinée. But this, of course, was a serial. It began as a serial in the paper. And I was given this rather strange shape for a comic, which was three columns wide of G2 by the depth of the paper. So it's a sort of giraffe, and I was used to doing horizontal, you know, comics are horizontal. So when I was given it, I thought, God, how am I going to use this? I was given 100 episodes, and it was going to be daily in black and white. In those days, The Guardian didn't have colour. And 100 episodes sounds quite a lot, but for the story that I'd chosen, which was sort of rather loosely based on Flaubert's Madame Bovary, it wasn't a lot. And the other thing is, I felt every day you needed to give the readers their money's worth. So narrative writing takes up much less space and is much more economical. Sometimes an image is economical, but I could get rid of a lot of kind of backstory and things that didn't need drawing just in three or four lines of text. So I used text like that. There was always a choice of what was going to be in text and what was going to be in an image. And obviously, for an image, I never had to describe anybody or the weather or their house or anything, because all the details would be there in the drawing. And images too, important conversations were, of course, drawn. And also the thing that I like very much in comics, which is there's silence sometimes, where you just have something happening with no balloons and no noises, and it's a sort of silent, rather filmic development. With the 100 episodes, I didn't have much space for that. But so I had to cram the story into these 100 episodes. That's why there was a lot of text. So when it was published as a book in France, I can remember, you know, there being kind of, you know, remarks saying, it's not exactly bande dessinée, you know, there's an awful lot of text. But,
yeah. Well, I like that. Hmm. When you're serialising something, do you plot it out before you get started so that it doesn't become meandering and, you know, you don't come lost halfway through the plot?
Yes, I should have. I mean, with With Madame Bovary, obviously the bones of the story were there, but the bones of the characters, I should say, were there. But the story is my story. I mean, my Gemma is a modern young woman, and I did write a kind of a thing like, you know, by episode 90. I remember she was going to, like Madame Bovary, she was actually going to kill herself. She was going to take an overdose, and I sort of wrote that in the outline. Two episodes before I was going to do that, I was doing roughs for episode, I think it is episode 90, and I drew her taking a lot of pills and things and writing the letter to Charlie. And somehow it wasn't in her character. It was though she kept sitting up and saying, I'm not doing this. And I was sort of going, die. And I realised that her character was such that she wasn't a suicide. She would sort of reinvent herself. So then I thought, oh, God, I've got to kill you now. So it was very much a kind of... I remember a whole afternoon thinking, how is it going to happen?
The character took control.
Yeah.
You do character studies, I think I read somewhere. Would you talk a bit about how you work out who your characters are?
I think I do that often before I've written anything at all. I mean, I would have had to have had the idea. I work in quite big notebooks, and I really start on the characters. I start drawing them. I start drawing their hairstyle, their clothes. If they've got a dog, I choose the dog. I think about their house, what their bedroom looks like. I ask them, you know, you sort of ask them questions. What kind of car do you drive? What kind of toothpaste? And mostly the clothes and the hairstyle do it. I mean, I've got the books up there. I can show you how Cassandra Dark kind of grew from. I knew she'd wear a hat, and I drew her first. I think she was wearing a beret, and then I was up west and. Where was I? It was a department store. Was it Phoenix? Now long gone. Anyway, there was one of those trapper's hats. I think they're called Chapka, and they got ear flaps and a thing. And I tried it, fur lined, and I tried it on. Pure hell, you were actually boiled alive in it. I mean, okay, from Siberia. But I thought that's what she'll wear, because it's like a helmet. And in a way, that's what Cassandra is. She wears a huge overcoat, big boots, and her big helmet-like hat, and she keeps the world at bay. Mm. And she's very rude and tells it to piss off.
Is there a question that you would suggest is good for people to ask that? You know, I'm just thinking a lot of writers and aspiring writers listen to this podcast looking for encouragement and motivation and so on. Is there a good question to ask a character that'll tell you something useful about them?
I think I ask Cassandra, what do you regret?
Oh, that's very good.
And sometimes what do you hope for at the end, which is not what I hope for as a writer, but
at the end of the story.
Yes, what you character, and I may thwart you by, but what do I imagine I think you want? And
that's brilliant. I love that. As you say, you've reworked some classics. Gemma Bovary is Madame Bovary, well, a version of Madame Bovary. Tamara Drew is Far From the Madding Crowd. Cassandra Dark has elements of A Christmas Carol. Why did those stories feel ripe for adaptation to you? Why did they strike you as suitable?
With Gemma Bovary, it was partly seeing a young woman in Italy who reminded us, we were in a cafe, it reminded us of Madame Bovary because she was with her lover and she was surrounded with her shopping and everything and sighing and full of terrible sort of despair. That and I, when I got back to England, I thought, I mean, she could be British. She could have bought a house in Normandy. I mean, it was that sort of thing. It would all fit. So I was quite with Tamara Drew. I didn't intend to hide a novel in it. It appeared in the Literary Review, and I can remember the editor there saying, "Are you going to hide a novel in it?" And I said, "Well, I don't know at the moment." But I had the idea of a writer's retreat, which I thought was quite a rich hunting ground, and I was writing the advertisement for this retreat, which would appear in something like The Author, or which would say, you know, lovely retreat, far from the madding crowd. And I went, far from the madding crowd? And then I'd read it before, and then I reread it, and I thought, actually, it could work. Mm-hmm. So I borrowed the five major characters from Hardy, and one or two things from his plot. And I suppose it's a slight... He's quite moralising, and it's got quite a sort of doomy ending, so I borrowed a bit of his gloom as well.
What are the challenges when you're working with somebody else's material? You know, did you have any nerves about those authors kind of rolling in their graves as they saw...
Well, I mean, I was really afraid that poor old Flaubert... I mean, it is a sort of homage... and I wondered if when it came out in French whether they'd be upset. But actually they liked it, yes.
This year you won the Grand Prix at France's Angoulême International Comics Festival. What was that experience like?
Well, of course I wasn't there because I didn't know. I think I knew I was nominated, and I'd already said I couldn't be in Angoulême last January because I had to have awful things done to my teeth and a whole, you know, range of appointments. And so, although I knew I was nominated, there was very strong competition, and I actually thought, I won't get... Anyway, so when I heard, I'd actually, you know, just had a 2 hours at the dentist. and so I was here in London, so I couldn't go. But, I mean, of course, I was thrilled. It was astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, first ever British winner and only the fourth woman to win in over 50 years. And that's incredible.
But yeah, I was very gobsmacked. Yes.
Yeah.
I wish there was another word. Like I should think of another word better than gobsmacked. Anyway, I'm very thrilled.
Yeah, that thing about being only the fourth female winner in over 50 years, has it felt in your career as though you're working in a bit of a boys' industry, a bit of a boys' club, or is it not something that really, I mean, affected you?
I think bande dessinée, the comics world has always been a boys' club, and that's changed very radically in the last, I don't know, 2020. There have always been women in the comics world. I mean, my experience is slightly different because I was in newspapers, and the bit of the newspaper I was on was the women's page, and my editors were women. So in a way... It was different, but I mean, I've had stories from women who've been in comics world, and they find it really difficult to break into. Mm. So it has been, you could say it's a boys' club, but it's changed a lot. There are lots. It's wonderful. There's lots and lots of young women doing very interesting things now.
Mm. What are you striving for in your writing?
In the paper, obviously, I was either seeking to entertain or annoy or anyway be of interest in and it was almost half a page of a broadsheet, so a big space. So it was quite a responsibility. What was I driving at? Well, to give the reader a good time to interpret some things about, especially contemporary life, as I saw them, as I noticed them. And I suppose in the days of letter writing and postcards, I did get a big post bag from readers who would often tell me what they'd been going or coincidences or sometimes they would tell me quite a sad letter, say about their divorce and say, you know, what do you think I should do? And I would write back and say, well, I'm really not equipped to tell you what to do. So, I mean, it was nice having that relationship with but I suppose for one's own pride, you actually want to do a good drawing or you want to write a conversation which is actually, you know, reads well, means what you want it to, yes.
Mm. Is there anything that you find particularly challenging? I suppose thinking more of the kind of writing, storytelling side as opposed to the drawing.
I think writing generally I find more challenging. When I was working on The Guardian, I wrote balloons a lot. I wrote conversations. I think Jim Bowrey was probably the most difficult thing I've done. It required much more narrative, much more writing, and that was very difficult. It was really when I found the narrator's voice. When I first began, I used the third person, and it was hopeless. It was just flat and awful. And it was only about a few weeks in that I was writing a scene with the baker, who is a French baker, and I was sort of listening to his voice a little in français, bien sûr, and I sort of heard his voice, and I thought I would write it in a slightly French inflected English, and also so there would be words in it which exist in French, which wouldn't, of course, in English, but would sort of. So he. You know, he talks about nervosity, quite a lot of nervosity. And of course there would be sort of jokes, like he would say, you know, the English have a great love of cottaging. talking about Gemma's cottage. because, the French talk about always putting ing about smoking and weekending and, you know.
Shampooing.
So, yeah, so I had fun with him, but it took a while to get his voice.
How did you translate all of that into French? I mean, when you published it in France.
Oh, I didn't do the translation.
How did they get across the humour of his sort of, his English?
I was lucky enough to have an absolutely brilliant, who's translated all my books, and she is so good, and she, you know, she'd email me, about the cottaging. She said, I know exactly what you mean, but it doesn't work in French at all. So, and also, for instance, Gemma's got the archers playing.
Yeah, they wouldn't know what that was.
But she translated it absolutely brilliant about, you know, chilly today, Shula, isn't it? You know, and she did it. And also those cricket terms, which she did wonderfully. So I must say I was really lucky.
Yeah. Do you remember any moments in your career where you realised something or you learnt something that really improved your writing?
Well, I think maybe what I've just been saying about Gemma Bovary, which was very, very difficult. The business of rewriting to get clarity and to actually say, what are you, you know, what do you mean here? I mean, my husband is a very good editor, and he would often read it and say, I don't know what you're on about, you know, or, you know, that works. So I think I learned a lot about storytelling then. I did some children's books in the 80s, and they were the first, really the first things I'd ever done in colour, because in the paper it was always black and white. And I can remember learning a terrific amount about colour just by doing them. Mm-hmm. And I found the colour quite frightening, because it's so, you know, in the paper, black and white or grey. So that was a sort of useful thing to have learnt. And also that picture books actually are really hard to do. They sound, you know, 24 pages of... But actually, to get a proper story is, you know, it's hard.
Mm. What are you proudest of when you think about your writing life so far?
When I was looking for work for the exhibition, the Pompidou exhibition last year, you know, I was looking through this plan chest, and I was actually quite surprised sometimes. I thought, well, that's quite good. I mean, that's all right. There are things I wouldn't have looked at for absolutely ages. Yes, some of the things, all right, yes.
Thank you so much to Posy Simmons for that chat, which I just loved. I'll put a link in the show notes to some of her work. All her books are great, but my personal favourites are Mrs. Webber's Diary and Literary Life. Over the last couple of weeks, I've been doing more in writing events around the country, and I've met some lovely listeners of the podcast, which has just been so nice. Thank you so much if you were one of those people who showed up. Next week, I'm teaching an Arvon masterclass online on Tuesday, doing an event at Caper Bookshop in Oxford on Thursday, and interviewing David Nichols at the Cambridge Literary Festival on Saturday the 23rd. So I'll put details of all of those in the show notes too, as well as a link to my book in case you want to have a look at it. It's also called In Writing. I think it would make a very good Christmas present for anyone you know who loves to write or is even just an avid reader. A reminder before we go that if you want to learn new writing skills, you can start today with Curtis Brown Creative. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. See you next week.